Hello, I'm Vicky Bourne, Minding Kingston's Counselling and Wellbeing Coordinator. Welcome to our podcast, Mind the Chat. It's where we talk to a range of people local to Kingston about their mental health experiences. Sometimes hearing how others have managed can be a huge help, and that's what we hope these podcasts will do for you. In this edition...
I never say that I'm someone who suffered from clinical depression. I always say I'm someone who has a mental illness and has to manage it very carefully.
That's Kingston resident Mark Rice Oxley. He's the author of a book called Underneath the Lemon Tree. It's a memoir of his depression and how he recovered. Anyone who's suffered from depression will know how difficult it is to put into words what they're experiencing. Mark's memoir was praised for capturing depression's visceral nature and writing about it with lyricism and poignancy. But let's start at the beginning. On paper, Mark had everything going for him. A wife, children, and a successful career as a journalist with the Guardian newspaper. Yet, at his 40th birthday party, with friends and family around him to celebrate, out of the blue, his world started to crumble.
So for me, in that autumn of 2009, you know, I'd stopped sleeping. There's all these different losses. You lose your circadian rhythm, so you don't sleep. You lose your appetite. You lose your interest in things. My mood was absolutely terrible. My rumination was just running away with itself. And I think a combination of those things, which all built up, and as I say, sort of hit me over the back of the head with a sort of a real crack in October 2009. And that was the point at which I thought, I'm in new territory here. This isn't like anything I've ever experienced before.
So can you tell us something about the moment when you realised that your feelings of depression weren't just something that were fleeting or transitory or likely to go away anytime soon?
That certain things you could sort of feel, for example, I've had insomnia before, but this was chronic, you know, not sleeping for days and days and days. And I'd had bleak moods before, but this was, you know, actually feeling suicidal. And I'd had, you know, sort of moments of anxiety and apprehension in my life. Of course, we all have. But this was a kind of gnawing physical anxiety that sort of settled in my stomach and stayed there for day after week after month, ringing through my hands. It was, you know, like the whole of my organism was being shaken by some kind of seismic movement. So I think, you know, when all those things come together, that's when you say to yourself, oh, hang on a minute, I'm not just feeling a bit low or a bit blue here. This is something that's really completely different, totally novel, and it needs treatment. It needed a very sympathetic GP who knew what she was talking about, needed a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist for me to really help me through those early weeks and months and sort of remain intact.
Mark was diagnosed with depression, but he thinks it's a word that doesn't do the illness justice.
Because this word depression is, I hate it. I mean, it's very misleading because, of course, we've all been depressed. Depression in that sense is really just a part of normal life. We've all been depressed in the way that we've all had a common cold, but we haven't all had pneumonia. And for me, it's that kind of relationship. So clinical depression is sort of the pneumonia to the common cold, which equals sort of being a bit depressed. And I've been a bit depressed in the past, but this was something different.
So what does he think triggered it?
I was a man leading very busy life with a job and three small children. And I've always been someone who loves doing a great deal of different things. And yet nothing was really very interesting to me anymore. And these kind of feelings came and went over a period of months. And each time they came back, they'd be sort of more intense and harder to ignore. And it built up to a big, what I can only describe as a sort of nervous breakdown in the autumn of 2009, which then led into a spell of what they now call clinical depression, which lasted for a good few months. And in fact, I feel like it's one of those things which once you've had it, you've kind of always got it. It's always there. It's part of you. So I never say that I'm someone who suffered from clinical depression. I always say I'm someone who has a mental illness and has to manage it very carefully.
And it sounds like that was your first experience of depression, is that right?
Well, I think it was the first time I had a mental illness that was unignorable and that completely took over my life. I think if I look back, and I was 40 at the time, and I think if I look back, there were probably precursors. There were probably times when I didn't know it at the time, but I was probably experiencing something akin to depression. I think a lot of us will go through times in our lives when we're not quite right. But no, this was the first time that it was something so kind of so extraordinary and startling that I had to face up to it and look at what was going on with me and try and figure a way out.
Well, it sounds like you were stopped in your tracks, really.
Yeah, I mean, I had to stop and I had to stop work for about 6 months in the end. And even after I went back, it still came back again and again to trip me up. You know, the reason I wrote the book and the reason that I like to do things like this is that I think that the key message for everybody and anyone out there who goes through something similar or even something very different that still ends up with them being diagnosed as having clinical depression is that you have to figure out what it is that tripped you up, what it is that tipped you into the depths of despair, because until you can do that, it'll be very hard to get out of it and stay out of it.
What do you think it was in your case?
Well, in my case, and I think in a lot of people's case, I think it's stress. And I think stress comes from many different sources nowadays. It could be the stress of a relationship breakup. It could be the stress that's prompted by a bereavement. It could be the stress caused in a car accident or the stress of being diagnosed with another illness. In my case, it was the stress of just running too hard and too hot for too many years and trying to do too many things, a burnout, if you like. And the hard thing about that is that then, I mean, it's too simple to say, right, in that case, I just won't run around and I won't work very hard anymore, because that's to deny your essential personality. There's a reason that I was the way that I was. And so you have to kind of be a bit of a scientist and a bit of detective about it and ask, well, why was I someone who felt it necessary to work 18-hour days? And why was I someone who felt it essential to make sure that I was looking after my children and my wife and my employer and still looking for freelance work and, you know, was only happy if I was always on? Why was I that kind of person? And for me, the only way to get out of it was to examine why I was the way that I was and what I could do about that.
So it sounds like you were quite a driven sort of personality and you needed a bit of self-reflection.
Yes, and perhaps a bit of self-love. I think that I come from a generation that's quite driven. I mean, I'm born in 69. I think my generation was really brought up to look at life as a series of hurdles. If you were privileged, which I am most definitely, and had opportunity, which I had most definitely, then life was all about achievement. It was about, getting good grades in GCSEs and A-levels and going to university and getting good grades there and then choosing a career and doing well there and trying to move on and up and get promotion and move to better places of work. And I think that for some people, of course, that will be fine because perhaps their essential personality doesn't have too many problems with the stress that that puts on themselves. But for me, in the end, it built up and up until I hadn't had any chance to decompress for a number of years. And I think I just snapped.
So have your views on how you should live life changed a lot since this time?
Well, they have for me. But I think I should be really clear for listeners out there to say that what happened to me for my reasons, and that other people will suffer from clinical depression or from mental illness for very different reasons. So I'm not going to sit here and say, yes, I reevaluated my life. Life should be a gentle, stress-free, lean-back, laid-back approach for everybody, because we're all very different.
And it's not always possible.
And actually, for me, sometimes in the intervening years since all this happened to me, it hasn't been possible. And I've had to, you know, sort of ramp up what I've done for short periods, but actually during lockdown, it's been quite fast and furious. But no, I have had a bigger reevaluation. I do now, for example, I haven't worked full time since 2010. I've been quite lucky that my wife also works, so I've been able to just stick at a 4-day week. You catch me on my day off, a Tuesday, when I actually don't really do very much. And I'm not ashamed of that. I kind of take that day as my buffer day, my decompression day. And that's one of the 4 or 5 things that I changed to try and make sure that what happened to me in 2009, 2010 doesn't happen again.
Yeah. And going back to that time, you tried a number of treatments with more or less success. What do you think helped you particularly?
Well, that's such a good question. I think about it again and again, because of course there are so many variables. So, you know, when you're in the pits of despair, you'll try a lot of different things. And I did try a lot of things. I guess what I should settle on and say that the things that have definitely helped me, because they're still with me now. Yeah, I used antidepressants and I still take a maintenance dose of that even today. I think I liken it a little bit to a stress fracture of the back, say, for example. If you got a fracture in your back, you'd need quite a bit of time for it to heal and quite a bit of patience and perhaps, you know, some tenderness and help from your family and friends, and then you'd need to stop doing what you were doing that gave you a stress fracture of the back in the first place. So for me, this is translate all of that to the mind, which is also an organ which can be overloaded and overtaxed and can break. Yeah, I had to stop overthinking things, so I'm quite into mindfulness now and meditation and yoga, and stop putting the same amount of pressure on myself that I used to. In those early days, yep, I took different kinds of meditation to try and figure out what would help me. I had a lot of love for my family and friends. I had my employer was really good to give me the amount of time that I needed for the physical breakage to mend. But it's been what I've done since then, with trying to make myself a little more psychologically flexible and change the way that I think. I think that's been probably the most important thing for me.
Okay, that sounds interesting. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, I think that, I mean, I'm a thinker. Again, I go back to my upbringing and the way that thinking always served me well. I learned, I thought, I passed exams. I went into an industry where thinking is what we do in the media. And when confronted with problems, I would think my way out of them. That's what sort of Homo sapiens does, this sort of thinking creature. But you know what? I found that there are times when, you know, thinking can turn against you. You know, thinking can turn into, you know, catastrophizing or overthinking situations and problems, and end up being wrapped up in your thoughts and caught too deeply in your thoughts. And particularly at the time of having clinical depression, that's almost a sort of a cardinal feature of the illness. You get caught up in this rumination, this overthinking. You know, will I ever be well again? Why has this happened to me? How am I going to get out of it? Will I sleep tonight? Will I feel better tomorrow? And actually, that's just making it worse. That's just putting more stress and pressure on yourself. So in the long run, and it took a long, long time, probably took 3 or 4 years, I just started to read around the subject and to do a bit of meditation and to just catch myself when I'm descending into those unhelpful, sometimes catastrophic cycles of negative thinking, and just to stand back and think, there go those thoughts again, you know, not to get caught up with them, but to stand back and watch them go past. And I found that to be a tremendously powerful way to achieve greater resilience.
Those dreaded thinking traps, they trip us all up, don't they?
And I do think that, as I said earlier, I think that there are many different ways to end up with a mental illness, with clinical depression. It can go back to your biology. You could have greater predisposition because of genetic factors. It might be something to do with the social environment in which you are, or, you know, some catastrophic events that are happening around you. But once you're in it, that this kind of destructive, ruminative thinking is common to everyone, and really the only way out is to find a way to sort of overcome it or rise above it, sort of not get dragged down with it, because in the end it just makes things worse and you're sort of doing it to yourself.
Yeah, so it's finding the right combination of treatments and effective things that work for you, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. And of course, we're all very, very different. So those treatments and what's effective and what isn't will be different for different people. But I think that everybody, in fact, whether you're ill or not, I think that everybody in our society could do a huge amount for themselves by learning a little bit about the pros and cons of overthinking and the ways to achieve sort of greater psychological flexibility and not always to believe everything that you think. You know, it goes back to the sort of some of those very basic CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy type examples. You're going to work, you're feeling a bit insecure, your boss passes you on the down escalator as you're on the up escalator, and she or he doesn't acknowledge you. And so what's the thinking that then ensues after that situation? And some people, for whatever reason, might start to overthink it. Oh, they don't like me. They don't like the piece of work I just did. I'm not in line for a promotion. I'm not progressing here as I'd like to. I'm not part of the in crowd here. And one thought leads to another and leads to another. And pretty soon you're feeling fairly miserable. And that's when you will start underperforming and everything becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And of course, you've done it to yourself. Actually, the person who passed you on the escalator was just very busy and caught up in their own thoughts, and there was absolutely nothing in that particular moment at all. But yeah, I think Shakespeare had it best when he said, "Nothing is ever good or bad, only thinking made it
makes it so." Absolutely. And there's the vicious circle of negative thinking can certainly affect us all, can't it? You spoke earlier on about the importance for self-acceptance and realising that depression was going to be part of you in the long term, and that it wasn't something that could be cured or would go away with the right combination of treatments. How important do you think that need for self-acceptance has been as part of your recovery?
I think acceptance is huge. And of course, it's always easier for me when I'm feeling well, which fortunately seems to be quite a common occurrence at the moment, than when I'm feeling, you know, really down in the dumps. I think that it's hard in this day and age with our 24-hour media and our constant reminder of what other people are up to really accept ourselves for who we are, particularly if there's something very dark and negative in what we have to accept about ourselves. But it's the only way of doing it, because the alternative is to start up with those unanswerable questions like, you know, why me? Why me, Lord? What did it have to... Oh, God, it happened to me again. It's always me, isn't it? And, well, I did quite a lot of work on acceptance in the early years. Now, I have to say, as I've been feeling particularly well, it's quite easy accepting being me. But there's someone very close to me who I was having this conversation with quite recently, actually, and he suffered a very serious stroke a few years ago. And we have long conversations about this, and it all comes back to acceptance. You know, it's the hardest thing for him is to accept that he'll never be the physical person that he was 5 years ago. And until you reach true acceptance with who you are now, you're constantly just going to be fighting against the chains and rubbing yourself raw on them and making one problem turn into two. So it is a huge thing for people to sort of look at themselves and think, yeah, this is who I am, not that aspirational person of 10 years ago or that garlanded and much decorated professional hero from 20 years back. But, you know, I'm just one of 7.5 billion people on the planet trying to get through the day and the week, and that's good enough.
And of course, along with self-acceptance is the ability to be able to talk openly about your experiences. And certainly when you wrote your book, you know, it was still relatively rare for people to talk very openly about their experiences of depression. And I mean, I'm not going back that long ago. I suppose it's 10 years or so now. Obviously, things have changed a lot in the last few years, thankfully. But that must have been quite difficult. It involved a bit of risk-taking.
Well, not for me, because I'm such a show-off and a big mouth. It wasn't something I went and sought, I have to say. I wrote an article for The Guardian because what had happened to me felt so extraordinary and unique that I felt I just had to get it out there. And of course, it turns out that what happened to me was not extraordinary or unique at all. It happens to millions and millions of people every year. But I think having written the first sort of draft of this down on paper, and then I was approached by people who asked me if I thought there might be more to say on this subject and a book in it. And I never really stopped to think, hang on a minute, if I do this, then everybody in the world will know. And that'll be, if you Google my name, that'll be the first thing that comes up. And I'll be typecast as the sort of mental illness guy forevermore. I never thought through those consequences. And if I had, maybe I'd have made a different decision. I don't know, because I would say to people listening that if you're very open about your illness, it will probably help you to recover more quickly, because you'll be being authentic and true to yourself as well as to the people around you, and then the people around you will also help you. But if the whole world gets to know about you, we're still in that stage, I think, where you could be discriminated against and it could end up harming career prospects. So it's still a very, very difficult line to toe. For me, when it happened, I couldn't hide it. I had to tell everybody, because I was in bed and stuck in the house for month after month. So people had to know. I'm also someone who simply can't keep a secret. So as I say, I will tell everybody every last thing about me if they've got enough time, or until they walk away. It's had more positive effect, I think, than negative in the long run, to write the book, to hear the feedback from people, and to start up, you know, short exchanges with readers about how things have been different for them, and to hear their advice as well. It's great to so you end up swapping advice and creating little communities of self-help. But yeah, people said they thought it was brave. I don't think it was brave. It may have been a little foolish and not thought through, but I don't think it was necessarily brave.
And talking about little self-help communities, you right now write a column which focuses more on uplifting stories. And I know as part of that, you've focused quite a lot on life under lockdown and positive things that have come out of that. I wondered if you wanted to say more about that, or anything that's particularly stood out for you during these last few months.
Well, there's a long answer and a short answer to that, Vicky. Before I was known for or wrote about mental illness, I was, and I still am, a journalist. And I've been a journalist for nearly 30 years. And I've worked for The Guardian newspaper for nearly 20 years. And for international news was always my big thing. And I spent a lot of time living overseas and travelling overseas and covering war, famine and pestilence. And it came to me in about 2016, when there was just so much really dire, miserable news happening. And at the same time, we were just starting to see the first of these surveys that were saying, you know, too much negative news is really affecting the morale and the mental equilibrium of readers and audiences. And it wasn't just me. We thought about this at The Guardian, and my editor-in-chief, who's a fantastic support when it comes to experimenting and trying new things, threw her weight behind the idea of having a series which tries to act as a counterpoint to all the negative news that's going on out there, and tries to start from a position not of where did it all go wrong, but where did it all go right? You know, what's working in the world? What are the ideas and innovations and solutions that can show the way forward to some of these huge problems that face us at the moment? So we started The Upside, as it's known, in 2018, and it has been going along its merry way for a couple of years, winning the occasional award, which is nice. And then lockdown came, and I thought, actually, at the time, goodness me, COVID-19, we're not going to be able to find any upside in all of that. You know, it's the worst thing, literally the worst thing that's happened to the world since 1945. But I was completely wrong. It turned out that not only was there just an extraordinary upsurge in human spirit and community and mutual help, and in innovation and in silliness and in resilience, just the most fantastic things that people have been doing. But also, there's a huge audience and a readership for it, because after people read about the death rate from COVID-19 and the terrible situation in our care homes and the awful situation with our economy, The next thing they really want is a little bit of hope and a little bit of optimism, and not a silly story about a cat that survived COVID-19 or a litter of puppies that was sort of born into the middle of a crisis. No, you know, serious, you know, the quest for vaccine, the heroes on the front line of our hospitals, and also our community heroes who are, you know, going out shopping and bringing food to their neighbours or volunteering in other ways. And it just turned out that this last 3 months, by and large, I think has been an amazing example of what human spirit can achieve, and what we're going to need if we're going to then confront some of the other really big challenges facing us in the 21st century, chief amongst them the climate and our mental health.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of us have been surprised, as you say, about the amount of people that have come forward and volunteered and really shown that they wanted to get together and get involved and support one another, which has been incredible.
You know, I think that people watch the news and think that the whole of the world is like what they're seeing on their screen. I'm digressing slightly here, but this is relevant to our mental health, because when you're watching the news, you have to remember that this has only made it onto the news because it's so extraordinary. It's such an outlier. It's such an example of something really deeply weird. The average normality of most people's everyday life is unremarkable. Most people lead gentle, unremarkable, unexceptional, and quite agreeable lives, probably more on the planet now than at any point in history. But of course, there are a few people every day, every week, every month who will be struck by some weird or unfortunate turn of events, and it makes it onto the news. And the mistake is to watch the news and think everything's gone to hell. No, it hasn't. These few events that you're seeing on your screen are deeply problematic, but most things are going along pretty well, in fact. I'd even say that at the end of this COVID outbreak, that there's still probably more hope and optimism out there in my mind than there is a sense that the whole thing might fall apart. And that's what we try to do with The Upside. And that's what I think news needs to do more generally, in order that we have a public that is engaged and hopeful and energetic and can do, and not sitting back on the sofa feeling helpless about everything. It's been great to be reminded that the vast majority of people, I think, have goodness in their hearts and want to make a difference, and understand that when they do volunteer or make a difference, actually, it's great for their own feelings of self-worth and for their own mental health. It's kind of a what's the word I'm looking for? A sort of...
A needed to be needed.
Yeah. I mean, it makes them feel good. It makes the people they're helping feel good. I mean, I think if my optimism's tempered by anything, it's by our kind of levels of public discourse and public conversation. We need to stop catastrophizing about everything. We need to understand the nature of risk and reward. You know, life is risky. No one survived it yet. So sometimes we will have to take risks. Sometimes bad things will happen to us, and we might just have to accept them as just part of the planet turning, rather than blame someone or some group or some people for doing it to us. I think if we can instill those attitudes in our younger generation, then I'm very optimistic about that we'll get out of this. We've got to avoid blame and recrimination and helplessness. And that does come from people like me in the media. The media does have a very big role to play in this.
Some of the things that have come out of this recent situation is the importance of maybe the simpler things in life. And one of those might be engaging with nature, which is something, again, you spoke very powerfully about in your book.
Yeah, well, I'm a country boy. I come from the darkest depths of Hampshire. And my mum was very much a gardener. And I always rejected it as a kid. I was much more into sports. And then as soon as I could, I raced off to the city. And I've always lived in cities ever since I was sort of 18. But I think, you know, the apple never falls far from the tree. I've come right back to it now. I find a tremendous power in the garden and in nature. Making something grow from a seed is such a powerful experience. It never fails to delight. I've really changed, Vicky, from, you know, someone who, you know, in my 30s was a bit scornful, actually, and a bit superior and a bit dismissive of lots of walks of life. And now I can see the purpose in gardening, the purpose in nature. I now have a dog. What was really good for me was understanding that not everything had to have a perfect outcome. Not everything had to get you an A star. And so when you're trotting around the garden, putting things in the ground, stuff dies and it doesn't matter. And when you go for a walk with a dog, you're not trying to climb up a ladder or get somewhere new or do something different. You're just passing the time and being in the moment. And certainly for someone who had my kind of psychological background, ideas like that are very powerful. I don't think they'll work necessarily for everybody, but I found that they've been part of my healing process.
Being local to the borough, Mark, I wondered if there was something specifically about living round here that you found helpful in your recovery process.
Well, two things, actually. I mean, firstly, it's a lovely part of the world, and Richmond Park in particular has been a kind of, like a constant friend to me over the years, and in different ways, in different times, in different seasons. I mean, when I was very ill, physically I was very weak, and I would get into the park and sort of shuffle around for a couple of hundred yards before going back home. And then as I built up strength, I could go further and further. So it became like a kind of voyage of discovery, really. How far will I go today? And of course, I've been back, I'm in there all the time with the dog now. There are times when I've used it to cycle around. I've met friends there. And that's the second thing I was going to say, that local friends, and particularly other dads in the borough, have been a real source of strength for me. There's almost a group of us who have all had our own kind of thing, nothing perhaps quite as dramatic as my thing, but there's a lot of fellow travellers out there. And we meet quite a lot, just one-on-one or in small groups. It sort of reinforces what I was saying earlier about, how open and honest can you possibly be about this thing? Well, I'm very open and honest, and my friends are pretty honest back, and I think that gives us a really kind of powerful Kingston dad support group. So yeah, I'm fond of the borough, and the borough has been my kind of rock through these past 10 years. I can't see me ever going anywhere else.
I was speaking there to journalist, author and Kingston resident Mark Rice-Oxley on his battle with and recovery from depression. Remember, if you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this podcast, do seek the help and advice of a medical professional. I'm Vicky Bourne of Mind in Kingston, and until the next time, take good care.